The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
In May of 2020, the world recoiled in horror at the viral video of a police officer, Derek Chauvin, kneeling on the neck of George Floyd. With his head pressed into the tarmac, the 46-year-old black man cried for his mother as he died a slow and agonizing death. That killing ignited the largest protest ever seen in the history of the United States, causing between $1 and $2 billion worth of damage to property. Across the world, millions more took to the streets to protest racial inequality. Coming up to the second anniversary of his death, my next guest has co-written a new book which examines the life and legacy of George Floyd and the America in which he grew up. Robert Samuel is a reporter with the Washington Post and the co-author with Tolu Olorunipa of a book called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, there was news over the last little while that one of the Minneapolis ex-cops, Thomas Lane, had actually pleaded guilty to second-degree manslaughter for his role in the death of George Floyd. Is that seen as a positive thing?
Well, there were four officers who had been charged in connection with the death, both on the federal level from the federal government and on the state level. Now, Derek Chauvin, he was convicted on the state level and pleaded guilty on the federal level. The three officers were convicted on the federal level, and so everyone presumed that they would plead guilty on the state level. That doesn't appear to be happening. So for the Floyd family who and many of the witnesses who endured this trauma and feel like they relive it every time they testify, seeing one officer plead guilty is seen as a positive thing for them. And I think everyone who's watched this case is wondering what will happen with the other officers.
Now, the book that you've written brings us right into the life of George Floyd, or Perry, I suppose he would have been known as a young fellow. What aspirations did he have in life growing up?
Well, when George Floyd was in second grade, that's when he was about 7 years old, his teacher did a segment about Black history. And then she asked, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And George Floyd, who had just learned about Thurgood Marshall, who was the first Black justice on the Supreme Court, the first Black judge on the Supreme Court, said he wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. So his first ambition was to become a lawyer and then to become a judge for cases. And I'll tell you one thing, Pat, when he wrote that little essay, he had all the words spelled right, his grammar was proper, and he was reading on grade level. Over the course of his life, though, people didn't see George Floyd, who was very tall, as a person who should focus on academics. They thought his way out of poverty was to play American football and basketball. And so his next ambition became becoming a professional athlete, and he was very good. But the irony was that because he focused so much on sports, and he was told to, he lacked the skills to meet the academic requirements to play in college. And so he never fulfilled that dream. And then—
So, that, I mean, you write about when he goes to a college stadium and he's there and he can imagine in himself, this is where I want to play, this is where I can play. But because he doesn't have the grades, he doesn't have his high school diploma, he cannot actually qualify. Even the fairly low level, I've met some of the jocks. I went to Georgia Tech for a year doing a master's. I met some of the jocks there. They mightn't have been the brightest sparks, but they still had to have certain minimal academic grades to get into the football.
Right, absolutely. And the question is, why didn't he have the grades, right? And the reason he didn't was because he was in an under-resourced school district. It was under-resourced because of the way the United States does pays for schools through property taxes. When white people left that school district because they did not want to integrate, it sucked out a lot of funds for the schools. And so many people who went to his school did not graduate high school. And so he did not have the academic requirements because his entire community wasn't shaped to believe that if you thrived in high school, it would lead to anything. And so he tried, but no, he did not have the academic requirements to continue playing football, which was for many people one of the big turning points in his life.
Now, there's an expression, Joe's no saint. Well, George or Perry was no saint either. He ended up in and out of the criminal justice system. He was into drugs, became addicted, and so on. I mean, he had, on the face of it, no real chance in life because of the way the criminal justice system in America has started to function.
Well, we go into this so in depth in the book, which I hope your listeners will pick up. But one of the things that continues to be a part of George Floyd's story is that the systems, the social systems that were supposed to help give a boost in life, particularly for those who grow up poor, never fully functioned in his favor. And that meant he had to work incredibly hard to be able to make a life for himself. And in a place where there was lots of disinvestment in the job community and not a lot of investment in job training, George Floyd, he gave into the economics of the neighborhood. And that was drugs. And because of...
You talk about his record. He has a record, and that becomes a vicious circle. You have a record, therefore more difficult to get a job.
Absolutely.
So what else do you do but go back to the neighborhood business?
Yeah, absolutely. And in Texas, where he grew up, when you start to have this record, you're in the cycle because you cannot get a professional license for a number of jobs. George Floyd, he could not even qualified to become a barber because of his record. And so in a lot of senses, he felt like he had no choice.
Yeah. And you talk about the incarceration system, which increased tenfold during George Floyd's lifetime. And, you know, Texas gave up on rehab and decided that punishment was the order of the day. But George did escape from Houston, Texas, and fetched up in Minneapolis. How did that happen?
So he sees a friend who steps out one day, and he's pudgier than he used to be. And he looks good. And he tells everyone that he's clean, he's sober, he's working. And his solution was he went to a rehab center in Minnesota. Minnesota has a more progressive spirit than Texas, though not fully, which is something else we get into in the book. But when George Floyd, he decides he wants that, he wants to change his life. So he goes to a pastor who hooks him up with a rehab center in Minneapolis. And for the first few months, it's going pretty well. He takes to the lessons. He gets clean, he gets sober, he gets a job, he gets another job, he gets another nice home. And for the first few months, everyone who knows him is really encouraged because it was the best he had looked and the best he had felt.
So he had a new life, and then it all went so tragically wrong for him. We know about George Floyd because of the video of his agonizing death. But in truth, there are many George Floyds across America.
Right. And I'll tell you, Pat, from a personal experience, one of the most wrenching parts of the book to report was when I started learning about all of the other victims of police violence in Minnesota specifically, and hearing the stories of mothers and wives and girlfriends who had lost someone they loved, who was by the police, they were killed by the police, And there were no cameras. There was no cell phone video. There was no social media. And they never got the small justice that George Floyd received. And it reminded everyone about the lingering problem and the lingering presence of police violence in the United States.
There is one extraordinary analysis in your book, well, among many, but the changing physiology of Black men. Mm-hmm. Explain.
So what we know, in the 1990s, research that is not, was once seemed fringe, but is now becoming even more and more supported, started looking at stress hormones within the Black body. And they noticed that there are heightened levels of stress hormones, things like cortisol. That's what we typically call the fight or flight response, right? Now, if you have a little bit of cortisol, it's good. You know, it can help you do an amazing feat or run away when you're scared. It helps you study for an exam if you're in university. But if it's sustained and elevated over time, it raises inflammation levels, which causes someone to be more susceptible to heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, two of those three things George Floyd had. And what science and research has concluded is that it is the stress of racism, the feeling of feeling like every day you might encounter someone, a prejudice or discrimination, and particularly for a Black man, that threat of a police encounter might be your last. It changes the physiology of the Black body. And racism actually can make you sick. And you saw that in George Floyd's life, that he had a sense of pride because of his race, but he also knew and understood that because that combination of race, being a man and being a large man that he was, that he was seen as a threat, and that bothered him. Science says that could really ruin your physiology.
He constantly told people he loved them, and indeed that's the three words you start your book with, I love you.
Yes. I mean, one of the things, I just mentioned about how people didn't think he'd be much of a loving person because he was so large. And so from early on in his life, he started telling people, I love you, because he wanted them to know. And because he also realized that being Black and poor could be a recipe for disaster at any time. So for those who knew George Floyd, it was not unusual and it was heartbreaking to hear him say, I love you, to those people as the life was being squeezed out of him.
You spoke to so many people in writing this book. You quote from President Biden, which really says it all about the fundamental thesis of your book. He says, at our best, the American ideal wins out. It's never a rout. It's always a fight, and the battle is never fully won. That's because the hate never goes away. It only hides.
Yes. President Biden, he was so generous in terms of being able to participate in this book. And what I wanted to know, what I asked, was why does he think racism still exists? Because I teach at a university, and that's the question my students always come to. Why is this still happening? We hope the book helps people understand why it's still happening and how, if we don't address the history of how Black people and other people of color, but primarily Black people, have been shaped and discriminated against in this country, it's hard to see a world in which hate ever goes away. And, you know, President Biden, he said to us that one of the things we have to figure out in America is how we can see success as something more than a zero-sum game. And we see that with what we call the white replacement theory. That's what propelled this supremacist to go and kill Black people who are just grocery shopping in Buffalo, New York. We see that in this idea that if one race elevates, another race has to compromise, has to sacrifice. And the question that the book posits is whether or not we as a country can move away from that zero-sum game.
Finally, when we talk about the legacy of George Floyd and certainly his death and the way it could be seen by everybody, witnessed every last agonizing moment of it, certainly does leave some legacy. But you wonder, every time there's a mass shooting like we had in Buffalo, in Vegas, all the other places where we've seen mass shootings, and, you know, someone stands up and says, you know, let this be the last time. It's never the last time.
One of the things that we talk about in the book, we also have this conversation with Reverend Jackson. And the question that I asked him is, how do you keep hope alive? What does that mean? And he essentially tells us to remember the arc of history. And when we think about the life of George Floyd, and we looked at a lot of his writings, a lot of the poems and diary entries that he wrote to himself or to other people, what you see is a continuing optimism that one day he will overcome the darknesses in his life and that he would live in a country that was more fair and saw people more fully. We hope that when readers go through the book, they can help see that and then begin to wonder, you know, if not on the large level, what they can do to treat people more fairly. And hopefully, if that amplifies, if that radiates, that's the optimism within journalism and telling stories, we could have a better tomorrow.
We've been talking about a new book called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. It's published by Bantam Press, and I've been speaking with the man who wrote it, along with Tolu Olorunipa, Robert Samuels. Robert, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you for having me here. I really appreciate it.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.